A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. We talked earlier today about some of those skills that can really be very important differentiators in terms of your success as a consultant that, as I said, have nothing to do with whether you're good as a developer, as an architect, or whatever you're doing. Things related to scope control, contracts. And I'd like to ask another one today that is more at the lead development side of things. Let's say that you have an inbound pipeline and you're getting some leads that come your way, or you know, people refer you for potential projects and you're busy. So I'm talking here about people who are maybe not quite starting out. Maybe to generalize, people in their early steps of their journey might be more focused on putting themselves out there, outbound lead generation. If you have this kind of a pipeline, an early lesson I learned is that regardless of where your leads come from, you can't make assumptions about baseline qualifications. You can't say, well, because they were referred to me, this is a higher signal, higher potential value lead, and I don't need to do the basic lead qualification that I might do in another situation. I think that's a false assumption to make. I think with lead qualification, there is a challenge because on the one hand, you don't want to come across as difficult to work with or send out the wrong signals from the very get-go. If you get someone who's, you know, potentially interested in working with you, you get an email out of the blue. You kind of don't want to come back with, well, can you clarify these 15 questions? And if you're worth my time, I'll get on the phone. And I'm just giving a flippant example. No one's actually going to approach it like that. But, you know, you don't want to come across as hostile. Equally, from experience, you do often want to do this, because if you don't even establish that there's a baseline potential fit, it can just be a real time drain. I'd love to get your take on what you think a happy middle ground might look like for a small team, whether it's two people or one people. Some people would take the view, I guess, that hop on every single call. Every single call is a potential opportunity. I guess from having done this for a while, I tend to lean more in the direction of do the baseline lead qualification, and if it passes, then jump on the call, but do that little bit of pre-vetting first. And I have to say as well, I'm terrible at formulating those emails where you realize that, wait, I don't know for sure, this is ambiguous, I should check this, and there is a voice in my head saying, oh, you're going to come across as difficult, don't bother. And I don't think people really take it that way. In fact, I think sometimes people appreciate if you're just a slight bit, you know, you don't just jump on a call the second they suggest, hey, this might be worth chatting about, because, and then it turns out that they're trying to see, do you need interns this summer? And it's totally irrelevant. Herman and Corin, let's talk about low touch lead qualification for solo consultants and busy freelancers. How do you get that balance right between vetting without giving potential leads the feeling that they're undergoing some sort of inquisition just to do business with you?
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a practical one. He's asking about lead qualification for consultants and freelancers who are busy enough to have an inbound pipeline. The tension is real. You don't want to waste hours on calls with people who want free interns or have no budget, but you also don't want to sound like you're running an interrogation before you'll even speak to someone. Where's the happy middle ground for low-touch vetting that doesn't make you seem difficult?
Oh, this is such a good question, and Daniel's framing of it is already more honest than most of what gets written about this. He admitted there's a voice in his head saying, you're going to come across as difficult. That voice exists in basically every solo consultant I've ever talked to about this.
By the way, today's episode is being written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, so if anything sounds unusually coherent, that's why.
Well, I hope it's coherent enough to help me unpack this, because I think there are at least three separate problems tangled together here. One is the actual qualification framework, what you need to know before you get on a call. Two is the social signaling problem. How you ask without sounding like you think you're too important to talk to them. And three is the self-discipline problem, which Daniel basically admitted to, knowing you should qualify but chickening out at the last second because you don't want to seem rude.
The third one is where most advice falls apart. Everyone knows they should qualify leads. Everyone's read the blog post saying have a discovery call framework, ask about budget, all of that. And then an email lands from someone who seems nice. And the little voice says, just hop on the call. It's only 30 minutes. And suddenly you've burned your Tuesday afternoon on someone who wants you to build their nephew's Shopify store for exposure.
And the sunk cost psychology here is brutal. Once you're on the call, you feel obligated to be polite for the full 30 minutes. Then you follow up with a polite no, and you've spent 45 minutes total. If you're a solo consultant billing, let's say, $150 to $200 an hour, that single unqualified call just cost you over $100 in opportunity cost. More if you're at higher rates.
Daniel's point about referrals is especially sharp. There's this unspoken assumption that a referred lead is pre-vetted. Someone you trust sent them, so they must be serious. But I've seen that backfire constantly. A referral just means someone mentioned your name. It doesn't mean the person has budget, a real project, decision-making authority, or even a clear idea of what they need.
There's actually some data on this that I think is useful. Sales research, and I know consulting isn't pure sales, but the lead qualification dynamics overlap, consistently shows that referred leads close at higher rates, but they are not immune to the basic qualification failures. A referred lead who hasn't been qualified still wastes your time. They just waste it with a warm introduction attached.
Let's get into the actual mechanics. Daniel's asking specifically about low-touch qualification for small teams or solo operators. What does that actually look like in practice?
I think the first thing to establish is what you're actually trying to qualify for. And I'd argue there are only four things that matter at the pre-call stage: budget, authority, timeline, and fit. If you don't have at least a tentative read on those four, you're not qualifying. You're just chatting.
The old Ben framework. Budget, authority, need, timeline. Though I've always thought need and fit overlap enough that you can collapse them for consulting work.
And the key insight is that you don't need detailed answers to all four before a call. You need enough signal to know the call is worth taking. For budget, you don't need a specific number. You need to know there is a budget and it's in a range that makes sense. For authority, you need to know you're talking to someone who can actually make a decision or strongly influence one. For timeline, you need to know if this is next month or next year. And for fit, you need to know the project is in your wheelhouse.
The counterargument I hear all the time is that some of these are too awkward to ask about in an initial email. People think asking about budget makes you seem mercenary or like you only care about money.
I think that's a framing problem, not a substance problem. If you ask, "What's your budget?" cold, it can land wrong. But if you frame it as, "I want to make sure I'm not wasting your time by being way outside your range," or "I want to suggest the right approach for the budget you're working with," suddenly you're being helpful, not nosy.
That reframe matters. You're not qualifying them like a gatekeeper. You're qualifying the fit, together. The language signals whether this is an inquisition or a collaboration.
Daniel mentioned being terrible at formulating those emails. I think that's where a lot of people get stuck. So let's actually talk about what a good, low-touch qualification email looks like. I've seen a few patterns work well.
Give me one.
The simplest one is what I'd call the gentle scope nudge. Someone emails saying they'd love to chat about a potential project. Instead of immediately agreeing to a call, you reply with something like, "Thanks for reaching out." Before we hop on a call, it'd be helpful to know a bit more about what you're looking to build and roughly when you're hoping to get started. That way I can come prepared with relevant examples and think through whether I'm the right fit for what you need. That's it. It's not 15 questions. It's not hostile. But it immediately filters out the people who can't articulate what they want.
The intern seekers and the "I just want to pick your brain" crowd usually evaporate right there because they can't answer those questions in a way that sounds like a real project.
And notice what you're not asking. You're not asking about budget directly. You're not asking who the decision maker is. You're asking about the project and the timeline. Those are completely natural questions that any reasonable person would expect you to ask before a call.
They also give you signal. If someone comes back and says they want a full e-commerce platform built in 2 weeks with no clear scope, you know this is not a real project. If they come back with a detailed brief and a realistic timeline, that's a different conversation.
And I think there's a second pattern that's useful for the budget question specifically, which is the range anchoring approach. Instead of asking what their budget is, you provide a range and ask if that aligns. Something like, for projects of this type, my work typically falls in the range of X to Y depending on scope. Does that align with what you had in mind? Now you're not interrogating them. You're sharing information about yourself and inviting them to respond.
That works especially well if you have a clear niche or a fairly standardized service. If you're a generalist developer who does everything from landing pages to back-end architecture, it's harder to give a meaningful range up front. But if you're specialized, say you build real-time data pipelines for logistics companies, you probably know that your engagements start around 30,000 and go up from there, sharing that filters fast.
Honestly, the people who are serious appreciate it. They don't want to waste their time either. If they have a $5,000 budget and you don't do projects under $25,000, they'd rather know that in an email than on a call where they've already invested 30 minutes explaining their vision.
There's another dimension here that I think is under-discussed, which is that qualification isn't just about filtering out bad leads. It's also about signaling competence. When you ask thoughtful, structured questions before a call, you're demonstrating that you're organized, that you've done this before, and that you take your work seriously. That's actually attractive to good clients.
A good client wants to hire someone who's selective and thoughtful, not someone who's desperate and will say yes to anything. The qualification process itself is a form of marketing. It says, I'm in demand, I'm organized, and I'm not going to waste your time or mine.
Let's talk about what not to do. Because I think the failure mode Daniel's worried about, coming across as hostile, is real if you do this badly.
Yeah, I've seen bad qualification emails. The worst ones read like a job application crossed with an audit. Please provide your company's annual revenue org chart and a detailed project specification before I will deign to speak with you. That's obviously terrible.
The tell is when the questions are all about whether they're good enough for you, rather than whether the fit is mutual. That's the tonal shift that matters. Qualification should feel like two adults figuring out if it makes sense to talk, not like you're judging whether they're worthy of your time.
I think there's also a specific mistake that technical people make, and Daniel alluded to this when he mentioned the lead development side. Developers and architects tend to jump straight to technical qualification. What stack are you using? What's your API architecture? Those are interesting questions, but they're not the questions that tell you whether this is a real project with a real budget and a real decision maker. You can have a fascinating technical conversation with someone who has no authority to hire you.
That's a trap I've fallen into. You get excited about the technical problem. You spend an hour whiteboarding a solution in your head, and then at the end you realize this person is a mid-level engineer who is just curious, and their VP has no idea this conversation is happening.
How do you avoid that? I think one practical tip is to always, always, always ask about the business context before the technical context. Who's the project for? What's the business problem it solves? Who's involved in the decision? If they can't answer those questions, the technical conversation is premature.
Let's talk about the referral case specifically, because Daniel flagged it, and I think it's the hardest one emotionally. When someone says, "Hey, Sarah recommended I reach out to you," there's social pressure. You don't want to seem ungrateful for the referral. You don't want Sarah to hear that you gave her friend the third degree. And so you're tempted to skip qualification entirely.
That's exactly the wrong instinct. I'd argue you should qualify referred leads the same way you qualify cold leads, but with a warmer tone. The fact that Sarah sent them means you can be a bit more casual, but the questions are the same. Thanks for reaching out. Sarah mentioned you might be in touch. Before we jump on a call, can you give me a quick sense of the project and where you are in the process? That's still a qualification question. It's just wrapped in a warmer context.
If the referred lead balks at that, if they're like, "I'd rather just discuss it on a call," I think you have your answer about how serious they are. A serious person understands that your time has value and wants to be efficient.
There's actually an interesting dynamic here that I think doesn't get talked about enough, which is that the quality of how someone responds to your qualification questions is itself a qualification signal. Someone who responds thoughtfully with clear information is demonstrating that they're organized and respectful. Someone who gives vague answers or seems annoyed by basic questions is showing you what working with them would be like.
That's a meta filter. The qualification process isn't just about the information you gather. It's about observing how the person engages with a structured process. If they can't handle two clarifying questions in an email, how are they going to handle scope discussions or feedback rounds during the project?
And this connects to something Daniel mentioned about not wanting to come across as difficult. I think there's a useful distinction between being difficult and being deliberate. Difficult is arbitrary hurdles. Difficult is being unresponsive or rude. Deliberate is having a clear process that you follow consistently because you take your work seriously.
The word deliberate is good there. It suggests intentionality without hostility.
Let me give a concrete example of what I think a good qualification flow looks like for a solo consultant. Step 1. The initial reply. You've got an inbound email. You respond within, say, 24 hours. Responsiveness matters. With two or three gentle qualifying questions about the project, timeline, and rough budget range. That's one paragraph, maybe four sentences. Step 2. You evaluate the response. If it's clear, thoughtful, and within your zone, you offer a call. If it's vague or out of scope, you politely decline or refer them elsewhere. Step 3. Before the call, you send a very brief pre-call note. Something like, looking forward to our call Tuesday. Just to make sure we use the time well, here's what I'm planning to cover. Do you have any specific questions you want to make sure we address? That last step is underrated because it sets the agenda and signals that this is a working session, not a casual chat.
The pre-call note also gives them another chance to self-disqualify. If they were hoping for a free consulting session, they realize you're coming in with structure, and they might bow out.
And the whole flow, from first email to scheduled call, might take 3 email exchanges. That's not an inquisition. That's just being professional.
Here's a question. What about the person who pushes back? The one who says, I'd really rather just hop on a quick call. I find it easier to explain verbally. How do you handle that without being the difficult consultant?
I think you have 2 options, and which one you pick depends on your read of the situation. Option 1 is to hold the line gently. Something like, totally understand, I find calls are more productive when I've had a chance to think through the basics first. Could you just give me a 2-sentence summary of the project and I'll make sure I come prepared? Option 2 is to take the call but put a hard time limit on it, 15 minutes, not 30, and you frame it as, I can do a quick 15-minute call to see if there's a fit, and if it makes sense, we can schedule a longer session. That way, you're not burning a full slot on an unqualified lead.
The 15-minute call is an interesting middle ground. It acknowledges that some people genuinely do communicate better verbally, and it's low risk for you. If it's a waste, you're out 15 minutes, not an hour. And it also serves as a qualification tool in itself. If they can't clearly articulate what they need in 15 minutes, that tells you something.
There's a subtlety here worth unpacking, which is the difference between leads who are inarticulate but serious and leads who are articulate but not serious. I've had both. The former might be a technical founder who's brilliant but not great at explaining things in writing. The latter might be a smooth-talking middle manager who sounds great on a call but has no budget or authority. The qualification process needs to handle both.
That's where the follow-up questions matter. If someone is bad at writing but gives you enough to go on, I'm working on a logistics platform. We need real-time tracking. Budget is roughly in the 50 to 100K range. That's enough. You don't need a polished brief. You just need enough signal.
Let's talk about the solo versus team dynamic, because Daniel specifically asked about small teams. I think the calculus changes when you're not the only person who can take a call.
If you're a 2-person shop, you can potentially split the qualification. One person handles initial screening, the other handles deeper conversations. That reduces the emotional burden of being the gatekeeper.
It also introduces a coordination cost. If both of you are doing qualification, you need a shared understanding of what qualified means. Otherwise, you get inconsistency, and inconsistency is worse than no qualification at all because it confuses your pipeline.
That's where having a written qualification checklist helps. It doesn't have to be formal. A shared Notion page or even a text file with the 4 or 5 things you want to know before scheduling a call. Budget signal, decision maker status, timeline, project type, source of lead. If both people are checking the same things, you avoid the situation where one partner is booking calls with everyone, and the other partner is wondering why the calendar is full of tire kickers.
I think for a small team, there's also the option of a shared intake form. Some people resist this because it feels impersonal, but I've seen it work well when it's positioned correctly. Instead of, fill out this form and maybe I'll get back to you, it's, I've put together a few quick questions that help me prepare for our call. If you can send these over before we chat, I'll be able to give you much more specific guidance. That reframes the form as a service to them, not a hurdle.
The form also standardizes the information you get. Email is messy. People forget to mention the timeline or the budget. A form makes sure you get the same baseline from everyone. And for a small team trying to scale without hiring, that consistency matters.
I want to go back to something Daniel said that I think is the emotional core of this whole question. He said there's a voice in his head saying, oh, you're going to come across as difficult. Don't bother. And then he immediately said, I don't think people really take it that way. That gap between the fear and the reality is what keeps a lot of consultants from qualifying properly.
It's a classic anxiety. We overestimate how negatively people will perceive our reasonable boundaries. There's a whole body of psychology research on this. People consistently think setting a boundary or asking a clarifying question will be received worse than it actually is.
In a business context, the asymmetry is even starker. The person emailing you is reaching out because they think you might be able to help them. They're already positively disposed toward you. A few professional questions aren't going to flip that to negative. If anything, they're going to think, okay, this person knows what they're doing, they have a process.
The people who would be offended by basic qualification questions are, with very rare exceptions, not people you want as clients. Someone who expects you to drop everything and jump on a call with zero context is signaling that they don't value your time. That's not going to improve once you're working together.
Let's talk about the exceptions, because I think they're worth acknowledging. Are there situations where you should just take the call?
I think there are a few. One is when the lead comes from a very high trust source. Not just a casual referral, but someone who has worked with you before, understands your work deeply, and has specifically matched you to this opportunity. If your best former client says, I told the CTO at my new company, she has to talk to you. I'd take that call with minimal qualification.
The trust is transitive there because the source knows both parties well enough to have done the qualification themselves. Another exception is when the project is unusually large or strategically important. If someone from a Fortune 500 company reaches out and says they want to discuss a potential 7-figure engagement, you probably just take the call. The upside is high enough that the risk of wasted time is worth it.
Though even then, I'd argue a light-touch qualification email is still appropriate. It's just shorter. Thanks for reaching out. I'd be glad to chat. Just so I come prepared, can you give me a 1-sentence summary of the initiative? That's still qualification. It's just minimal.
I think the point is that qualification isn't binary. It's a spectrum. You can do heavy qualification for cold leads, medium for warm referrals, and light for high trust or high value opportunities. The mistake is doing zero qualification for anyone.
Let's talk about the other side of this, which Daniel hinted at but didn't fully explore. Once you've qualified a lead and gotten on the call, what then? Because qualification doesn't stop at the first call. The first call is itself a qualification step.
The pre-call qualification is about filtering out obvious mismatches. The call is about deeper discovery. And I think a lot of consultants make the mistake of treating the first call as a pitch. They spend the whole time talking about themselves, their process, their past work. That's backwards. The first call should be mostly questions.
How do you structure that first call so it continues the qualification without feeling like an interrogation?
I like a framework I learned from a consultant friend years ago. He called it the three buckets. First bucket is about the problem. What are you trying to solve? Why now? What happens if you don't solve it? Second bucket is about the context. Who's involved? What's been tried before? What constraints exist? Third bucket is about the commitment. What's the budget range? Who makes the decision? What's the timeline for deciding? And he'd spend maybe 70% of the call on the first two buckets and the last 30% on the third, because by then you've built enough rapport that the budget conversation feels natural.
Building rapport before asking about budget is smart. It's not manipulative. It's just sequencing. Once someone has spent 20 minutes explaining their problem in detail, And you've shown that you understand it. Asking what they've allocated to solve it doesn't feel abrupt. It feels like the logical next step.
If they can't answer that question, that's useful information. It doesn't necessarily mean there's no budget. It might mean they haven't thought about it yet, or they need to get approval, or they're hoping you'll tell them what it should cost. All of those are fine, but they change how you handle the next steps.
I think there's a specific failure mode here that's worth naming. The consultant who's so afraid of losing the lead that they never ask the hard questions. They spend the whole call being agreeable. They send a detailed proposal. They follow up 3 times, and then they find out there was never a budget or the decision maker was never in the room. That's not a qualification failure. It's a courage failure.
When you ask about budget, decision process, and timeline, you're demonstrating that you've done this before and you know what it takes to get a project done. That builds confidence.
It also lets you tailor your proposal. If you know the budget is $50,000, you can propose a scope that fits $50,000. If you don't know, you're guessing. And guessing leads to proposals that are either too expensive and scare them off, or too cheap and leave money on the table.
Let me bring this back to Daniel's original question about the happy middle ground. I think the middle ground is this: have a consistent, lightweight qualification process that you apply to every lead, regardless of source. Make it friendly, make it about mutual fit, and keep it to 2 or 3 questions, max in the initial email. Don't skip it for referrals, don't skip it when you're busy, don't skip it when the person seems nice. The process protects you from your own optimism.
The process should be written down, not in your head. In your head, it's subject to the little voice that says, this one's different, just take the call. If it's written down, you're following a system, not making a judgment call every time. That removes the emotional weight.
I'd go a step further and say you should have email templates. Not robotic ones, you customize them. But the skeleton is there, so you're not staring at a blank screen trying to figure out how to ask about timeline without sounding rude. Daniel admitted he's terrible at formulating those emails. Templates solve that.
The pushback I've heard on templates is that they feel inauthentic. But I think that's backwards. A good template is just your best thinking, captured in advance, so you don't have to be brilliant on the spot every time. You're not being less authentic by using a template. You're being more consistent. The authenticity is in the thinking that went into the template.
And you can always add a personal touch. If the lead mentioned something specific, reference it. If they came through a referral, name drop the person who sent them. The template is the structure, not the content.
Let's talk about one more thing Daniel raised, which is the fear of sending out the wrong signals from the get-go. I think this deserves more attention because it's not just about qualification emails. It's about your entire posture as a consultant.
What do you mean by posture?
I mean the overall impression you give about how you work and what it's like to work with you. Qualification is part of that, but so is how you write proposals, how you handle scope changes, how you communicate during projects. If your qualification process is thoughtful and professional, it sets the tone for everything that follows. If it's sloppy or non-existent, that also sets a tone.
The qualification stage is the client's first real experience of working with you. Not the first impression, that's your website or your portfolio or the referral, but the first actual interaction where they're trying to do something with you. And that interaction teaches them what to expect.
If you're disorganized in the qualification stage, they'll assume you're disorganized in the project. If you're overly accommodating and never push back, they'll assume they can push you around on scope. If you're needlessly rigid, they'll assume you're going to be a pain to work with. The qualification process is a microcosm of your consulting practice.
The goal is to be professional, structured, warm, and efficient. That's the sweet spot, not an inquisition, not a free-for-all, a process that respects both your time and theirs.
I think the thing to remember is that good clients want this. They don't want a consultant who's desperate and available. They want someone who's in demand, who has a process, who asks good questions, and who isn't afraid to say, this isn't a fit if it's not a fit. That's the person they trust with their project.
There's a quote I like from a consultant I used to work with. He said, the way you say no to bad projects is the same way you say yes to good ones, with clarity, respect, and speed. The qualification process is just the mechanism for figuring out which is which.
That's good. And it applies to the email stage too. If someone sends you a clearly mismatched inquiry, a quick polite no is better than ghosting or stringing them along. Thanks for reaching out. This doesn't sound like a fit for what I do, but I hope you find the right person. That's 30 seconds to write, and it leaves a better impression than silence.
Ghosting is the real hostility, not asking clarifying questions. I think people forget that. Asking questions shows you're engaged and considering the opportunity seriously. Ignoring someone shows you don't care.
To summarize what we've covered for Daniel's question, have a consistent, lightweight qualification process. 2 to 3 questions in the initial reply, focused on project scope, timeline, and budget range. Frame it as preparation, not interrogation. Use templates so you're not reinventing the wheel each time. Don't skip qualification for referrals. And remember that the process itself is a signal of competence.
I'd add, if you're really struggling with the email formulation, start with a range anchoring approach for budget and the gentle scope nudge for project details. Those two patterns cover most situations. And if someone pushes back hard on even those light questions, that's useful information about what working with them would be like.
One more thing. The voice in your head that says you're being difficult. Acknowledge it, thank it for its concern, and then follow your process anyway. The voice is trying to protect you from social discomfort, but it's not giving you good business advice.
That voice is optimized for avoiding awkwardness at a dinner party, not for running a consulting practice. Different context, different rules. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1950s, dyers along the shores of Lake Tanganyika produced a distinctive crimson pigment by fermenting crushed lock insects in clay pots buried in the lake shallows, where the cool, stable water temperature allowed a slow enzymatic reaction that yielded a shade impossible to replicate with synthetic dyes of the era.
Right. This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, and to Daniel for the question. If you want more episodes, you can find us at My Weird Prompts.
If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps more than you'd think. We'll catch you next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.